Welcome back to the program. The war in Afghanistan is, by most accounts, not going well. This month, the administration will be conducting a full review of our Afghanistan policy. However, any such review to be effective must assume a real understanding of what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan and in the tribal areas of Pakistan. However, there's no reason to assume that we have that understanding. However, our guests this morning, David Rohde and Christian Mulvihill, have perhaps a greater understanding of what life is like in that region, what life is like under the Taliban, and the real state of affairs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. David Rohde is the winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes in journalism. He's a reporter for the New York Times and the author of the book Endgame. Christian Mulvihill has been a fashion and photography editor at various women's magazines, including Marie Claire and Self. Together, they're the authors of a new book entitled A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. David Rohde, Christian Mulvihill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Great to have you both here. David, start with you. Tell us about what happened back in November of 2008. You were on a story. You were about to do an interview with a Taliban commander outside Kabul.
Yeah, I was actually working on a book about Afghanistan since 2001, and you know, I had seen what you were talking about, how things have not turned out as hoped, you know, since then, and I felt that for the book to be as comprehensive as possible, I should try to get the Taliban side of the story. I found a Taliban commander who had done interviews with 2 other foreign journalists. I met with one of those journalists, and she was a European. She said, you know, I don't believe he'll kidnap you. You know, there is more danger if he was an American. But, you know, you should be okay. And unfortunately, the commander kidnapped us when we arrived at the meeting point for our interview.
Had you been aware of other journalists that had had these kinds of meetings and that had gotten through them safely?
Yeah, dozens of journalists have successfully interviewed the Taliban. It's really a question of which commander you know, partly luck, and, you know, I was unlucky. Many, you know, the majority of interviews, I think, have gone safely, but there have been kidnappings in other cases.
What was your sense of your own personal safety going into this?
One of the things, and this came up early in the kidnapping, was I had done extensive reporting on the war in Bosnia and helped expose the execution of roughly 8,000 Bosnian Muslims in a town called Srebrenica. And I knew it was dangerous. I always thought that past reporting might help me with the Taliban to show them that I'm an independent journalist. I was actually detained by Serb forces in Bosnia. They're sort of Christian nationalists. So in the very early days of my kidnapping, I told this Taliban commander about that reporting, but it made no difference whatsoever. They said that simply makes you worth more money.
Christian, you and David had just gotten married a couple of months before this incident happened. What was your concern about David's safety over there?
Oh, gosh, you know, we had talked about what to do if anything ever happened to him, if he was injured, if he died. We never really discussed kidnapping. I had no idea in the early moments who had him. I feared he'd be killed, obviously. And as the case progressed, I feared he'd be held indefinitely. And I had concerns he was being held by militants, you know, not by government. So I was very concerned they'd use him as sort of a PR negotiating tactic.
How did you first find out what had happened, Kristen?
I actually had just started a job at Cosmopolitan magazine, and this plays throughout the book, tremendous contrast between dealing with the Taliban and dealing with, you know, bachelors for Cosmo and whatnot. So I was in my office, you know, on a Monday afternoon, finishing up some touches on our Cosmo shoots, and my brother-in-law called and said that David hadn't returned from an interview. And, you know, I really felt like it was having a worst fear come true. But very quickly, you know, gathered myself and was thrown into this world of, you know, managing some aspects of the kidnapping, dealing with the FBI, dealing with the State Department, private security teams in the New York Times.
Did you have any idea, David, what people back home might know and to what extent they would know it?
I had some sense because what my captors did was quickly move me from Afghanistan. We were kidnapped just outside of Kabul. Over the border into the tribal areas of Pakistan, and they were much more comfortable there. That's, as you talked about in the introduction, that's where the Taliban have a sort of sanctuary where American troops can't carry out raids, and the Pakistani military really isn't confronting them. So they let me call Kristen 9 days into the kidnapping. And, you know, they were very comfortable about me making the call. I was sure it was being traced. So I knew they didn't know good things at home, because it's not a good sign when you're taken into the tribal areas of Pakistan.
With your reporter's hat on, however, what were you witnessing in those tribal areas? What were you seeing with respect to this kind of mini-state that the Taliban had established that really was providing new information for you?
To be honest, I shifted pretty quickly from trying to report to simply trying to survive. And I hesitated when we escaped from captivity and returned home. I wasn't even sure I was going to write anything. But I did, it was astonishing. It was essentially a Taliban mini-state. There were, Taliban police, Taliban construction crews repairing the local roads. The schools were run by the Taliban, and Pakistani forces had abandoned their checkpoints on the main roads, and they were essentially confined to these large bases, but they almost never came off of them. My guards took classes in how to make roadside bombs that would kill American soldiers in this sanctuary in Pakistan, and these enormous explosions would go off, but Pakistani forces would never come off their bases to investigate them.
You talk about the fact that, in fact, the alleged potential Times Square bomber had trained in one of these camps.
Yes, what's sort of disturbing to me personally is, we escaped 17 months ago. I wrote about this in a series for the New York Times a year ago, and the American government has repeatedly asked the Pakistani military to move into this area, and they have refused to do so. Faisal Shahzad, roughly a year after our escape, was trained in that area and then tried to set off that bomb in Times Square. Unfortunately, it did not detonate. This recent case in Portland of the young man trying to set off a bomb at a Christmas tree lighting ceremony, the details aren't as clear, but he also was in touch with or trying to contact people in Pakistan as well. So the tribal areas are, they're killing American soldiers from that sanctuary, and they're also plotting attacks in the United States.
And what we seem to see repeatedly is the Pakistani government kind of turning a blind eye to all of this.
Well, what's really going on is it's the India-Pakistan rivalry, and they feel that the Indian forces are Indians basically trying to gain an advantage in Afghanistan, and they're trying to so they back the Taliban because they're basically seeing the Taliban as a proxy force that for Pakistan that will prevent India from gaining control of Afghanistan, and if somehow India and Pakistan, with some help from the U.S., could reduce, their own rivalry, that would, I think, help stabilize Afghanistan. There was just a WikiLeaks cable where the U.S. ambassador says this very clearly, that says that basically as long, the more Indian investment and trade and influence there is in Afghanistan, the more Pakistan is going to back the Taliban as their own kind of local ally.
How were you treated while you were in captivity?
I was treated very well. I was never beaten. I was surprised by that. I was actually given bottled water. They let me listen to the radio regularly. But it was all very contradictory. They would sort of treat me well, and yet they were terrorizing my family and, sending out these videos demanding. Their initial demands were for $25 million in ransom and the release of 15 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They were just, ridiculously high demands.
Did you have any sense, David, that there was any kind of an end game that the Taliban had for this kidnapping?
No. As long as, I was in this sanctuary in Pakistan, it seemed like they felt they could hold me for years, and they have held other hostages there for years. There's many Afghans and Pakistanis that are taken captive that don't get this kind of attention. And one of the reasons we decided to escape was because we felt that it was so clear. They, 7 months had passed. Their demands were now at roughly $8 million and 4 prisoners. And they were really delusional about, they believed, for example, that if you remember the case where the American sea captain was kidnapped off of Somalia, They didn't believe the story that American Navy snipers had shot the pirates. Instead, they believed that the United States had secretly paid United States government had secretly paid a $25 million ransom, so they were just delusional.
Kristen, talk a little bit about your contacts as they would begin to evolve with the U.S. government and the initial desire to keep this kidnapping a secret.
Well, the FBI is the lead agency on all kidnappings of U.S. citizens, So very early on, they swooped in. They trained me how to take telephone calls from the captors. They, you know, told the family about how the case might progress based on other cases. But they really, in the end, could not negotiate for us. They couldn't, you know, exchange funds or release prisoners. So with that in mind, we wound up hiring a private contracting firm. In terms of keeping it private, you know, I really felt David would not want to be part of a story. But beyond that, we really felt, you know, it would be a danger to go public. I stand by that decision. It was not a decision the family made lightly. The New York Times was tremendous in honoring it. I know, you know, it went against every instinct they had as journalists to not report the story. But when we found out who he was being held by, he was being held by the Haqqanis, a very extreme fraction of the Taliban. We really did not want to give them a platform to try to negotiate publicly with our government.
Talk a little bit about the New York Times and, mm-hmm. and their attitude in not reporting this story.
I really think there was somewhat of a precedent before David's case. A woman by the name of Melissa Fung had been kidnapped. She's a Canadian journalist just prior to David and released about a day before David was taken. And her case had stayed out of the press. There'd been an agreement not to report on her case. In addition, I met with several former hostages while David was away, one of whom had been held by the Taliban the year before. And his case was never mentioned in the media. He was with a television channel. So there's a bit of a precedent for it. I really think there's reciprocity between news agencies. And then beyond that, I think there was tremendous camaraderie, you know, between David's colleagues and other news organizations. And that really enabled us to keep it quiet.
How helpful was the FBI and what other government agencies were brought into this?
As I said, the FBI was great in terms of, you know, telling the family how things might progress. They were able to figure out not specifically where David was, but they were able to trace some of the calls. So that was helpful. The family, you know, reached out to the State Department. This took place during the Bush and Obama administrations, so we dealt with both. When Obama came into office, Richard Holbrooke, the State Department, was tremendously helpful to the family. You know, there was a sense that perhaps David's captors were assets of the Pakistani intelligence agency known as the ISI, and that the ISI could perhaps pressure the Haqqanis to release him. So Holbrooke went to them and said, you know, please, please tell them to release David or at least continue to talk to the family. It didn't seem to work. I don't know if the captors didn't listen or if, you know, the ISI didn't do anything. But in the end, ultimately, you know, when David was in Pakistan after his escape, our State Department called the Pakistani government and said, we know where David Rhoda is. Please make sure he gets out of your country safely.
Was the CIA involved at all?
I did not talk directly with the CIA, but in terms of being an intelligence gathering agency, you know, in that part of the world, I think behind the scenes there may have been some, you know, intelligence gathering going on.
What was it like for you, Kristen, going about your business day by day, as you mentioned before, knowing what was going on with David and knowing that there was really no sense of when or how or if this might come to some kind of conclusion?
It was very difficult, and initially, in the, you know, the first 6 months, I held on to my job, but was ducking, you know, out to meetings with the FBI, with the New York Times, and making trips to Washington. Initially, having some sense of normalcy with a daily job was a comfort, and then over time, it was just too extreme to juggle those two worlds. And, you know, we tried all kinds of ways to get a hold of David's captors when they would go quiet. I wrote letters to Taliban elders. You know, I don't know if they ever saw them. I sent a video back in as well from our family, you know, asking for his release and whatnot. In the end, I really felt that the outcome was going to be beyond our control. And, you know, family was tremendously supportive, and my faith. I am a spiritual person, so that really helped me get through each day.
Was there any point that you thought about simply getting on a plane and going to Afghanistan if you could?
Yes, there were two points, actually. In the beginning, you know, I would have gone to Afghanistan, but very quickly we found out he's actually not in Afghanistan.
Right.
They've moved him to Pakistan. So with that in mind, I think I had purchased tickets twice. The first time I was ready to go, I actually received word in New York that a video had been sold of David, and it was going to be delivered to New York, and the family was going to be able to view it, so I stayed put. And then the second time I was going to go, about a month after that, 2 days before I was supposed to go, David phoned home. I hadn't heard from him in 3 or 4 months, and then the Taliban told me they would be calling, so I stayed in New York. And, you know, I agonized over that during the case, but I actually think had I gone to Pakistan, had I been a guest of, you know, the U.S. Embassy, it would have looked like we were both spies. It would have looked like we had tremendous amounts of money for me to be able to do this, and I think it would have complicated things. I didn't realize that at the time, though.
David, one of the dangers that you faced was not only the danger from your captives, but the danger of being in a war zone and the U.S. attacks, particularly the drone attacks that were going on in that region. Talk about that.
Yeah, I witnessed the drone strikes and how they impacted people on the ground. They are generally accurate. Clearly they kill civilians, but the Taliban exaggerates the number of civilians. They would be very angry at the drone strikes. In particular, there was a drone strike that killed many Uzbek militants that were teaching Afghan Taliban and Pakistani Taliban how to make bombs, and my guards were very angry about that. And they clearly, the Taliban feared them. They were hesitant to gather in large numbers because of the drone strikes. But I didn't feel like they were sort of turning the tide. If anything, they were kind of continuing a stalemate in the tribal areas where a leader would be killed, but a younger person would sort of replace them. And until the Pakistani military moves in there, you know, the drone strikes aren't going to really change the situation. It's kind of a stalemate.
Was there a concern that to the extent these drone strikes continued and civilians were killed, that they would be some kind of a retaliation and that you would be the victim of that?
Yes. There was one specific drone strike that occurred just outside a house I was being held in. Two cars were driving by with Arab and Pakistani militants in them. My guards were enraged when this happened. There was pieces of shrapnel from the missile landed in the yard we were in and lots of dirt. And, you know, there was one guard I read in the book that, you know, talked about killing me there and videotaping it in revenge, but other guards talked him out of it. Their greed, in a sense, was stronger than their desire for revenge. And instead, what happened was, and this happens across the tribal areas, a local man, a local farmer in the tribal areas, was declared a spy by the Taliban. They said he had somehow secretly guided the missile strike. The man denied it, so they then tortured him. They cut off his leg and disemboweled him. At that point, he apparently made a false confession, and then they then decapitated this farmer, and they hung his body in the local market as a warning to other local villagers.
Talk a little bit about some of the other things that you, David, witnessed over there that made you really think that this was not going to come to a satisfactory end, that really sort of set the stage for the need to escape.
It was basically it's an alternate universe that the Taliban live in there. I was living with these guards who absolutely believed that this was a religious war. They felt that the United States, you know, 9/11 had been staged, and that American troops, they had been told, were forcibly converting Afghan Muslims to Christianity. They had been told that Afghan women were being forced to work as prostitutes on American military bases. And they saw sort of a vast kind of Christian-Jewish-Hindu alliance that was basically trying to enslave Muslims, none of which is true, but this was all they sort of know about the outside world. I live with a young suicide bomber. And I asked him, you know, will you miss your parents and your siblings when you die? And he said no, because the only relationship that mattered, you know, in this world is one's relationship with God. And it was fascinating because it was kind of I was able to see how removing kind of these emotional and psychological ties between these young men and their families plays a vital role in getting them to carry out these kind of attacks. This young man had been told that, you know, the United States people were just obsessed with the pleasures of this world. He had been told that all Christians want to live for 1,000 years, and that a necktie was a secret symbol of Christianity.
How did you begin to plot and plan the escape?
The last house we were held in, we were moved to various houses, and this one was the closest we had ever been to the one Pakistani military base in the town. We were being held captive, and it's called Miranshah. And we realized that if we were going to try to make an escape, we should do it there and essentially try to go to the base. Also, when I moved into the town, it had been used, the house before had been used by Taliban fighters, so there was sleeping bags and sort of blankets and things strewn all over the house. And on one shelf, I found a car wrench and a car tow rope. And we realized that we could use the tow rope in an escape. And what we essentially did, the third thing was that the power came back on. That then made some noise with ceiling fans and other things that were running in the room where we slept with the guards. So we crept out of the room where we were sleeping with our guards, used the tow rope to lower ourselves down a wall, and then walked to this Pakistani base. We spent about 10 minutes standing in front of the base with our hands up. The Pakistani guards thought we were potentially suicide bombers. I had a very long beard at this point in local clothes. After we laid on the ground for several minutes, took off our shirts, we were finally allowed onto the base by this wonderful and young captain, a Pakistani army captain, who apologized to me for the kidnapping, gave me a book called The Glorious Islam. He was a moderate himself, and the Taliban had completely distorted Islam, and he totally disagreed with them. And then he let me call New York, and I called, and actually my mother-in-law answered the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible job of getting all the details right about where I was being held, and we were flown out by a helicopter several hours later by the Pakistani military.
Kristen, when did you first hear about David having escaped?
I actually, as fate would have it, when David called home, I was not home. I was a couple blocks away from the apartment. So my mother called me on the cell phone and said he'd escaped out of the blue, you know, on a Friday afternoon. And I ran home. And she'd written all the details of where he was on a little sticky pad, and there were sticky notes strewn across the living room sofa. And very quickly, you know, we started calling U.S. government officials along with an editor from the newspaper, and they were able to help exit him from Pakistan.
David, given all that you went through over there, all that you witnessed over there, how has this shaped your view of the whole American involvement over there right now?
Unfortunately, I believe that this U.S. troop surge won't work as long as these sanctuaries exist in Pakistan. That's kind of problem number one. Problem number two would be the continuing corruption in the Karzai government. You know, that has to be addressed. And I think a third key thing would be to, and this is happening, is to increase the number of Afghan troops that the U.S. is training. Afghanistan and Iraq are roughly the same size, but the U.S. has trained three times as many soldiers and police in Iraq as they have in Afghanistan. It really was a paltry American effort until the last year or two. There are moderates in the region. They saved my life. It's very important that we continue to back them. I don't think simply walking away is an option. You know, the Times Square case shows that it is a direct threat to the United States. But we have to kind of, you know, change those three things I mentioned, or the effort will fail. I don't think, you know, military escalation is the answer solely, or simply walking away is the answer. We've got to find a kind of comprehensive middle ground and stay at it and be patient.
Do we have a sense of how large the Taliban movement is in this region of Pakistan?
They are strong in this sort of remote mountain areas, but, you know, public opinion polls still show that only roughly 10% of Afghans and roughly the same amount, same number in Pakistan support the Taliban. They're just ruthless, and as long as they have this sanctuary and as long as there's kind of this continuing India-Pakistan dynamic, you know, they're able to kind of take advantage of that. They really aren't popular in either country, but there's a lot of mistrust of the U.S., a sense that the U.S. will leave. Many people blame the U.S. for leaving after the Soviets withdrew in 1989 and sort of allowing chaos to ensue there. So there's just a question about how consistent American policy will be.
How will this experience affect your work and your reporting going forward, do you think?
My days as a war correspondent are over. My wife and family have been through enough, so I'll continue to be a journalist, but I won't be working in conflict zones anymore.
And Kristen, if David came to you and said, well, maybe one more time I want to go here.
I don't think he'll do that. Look, I support support his work as a journalist. His decision not to go back to the region was his own, but I do fully support it.
David Rode, Kristen Mulvihill. The book is A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. It's just out from Viking. David, Kristen, I thank you both for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.